branch of the Mennonite church world, and I'll acknowledge at the beginning, my own background is Old Order Amish, and I didn't realize the difference between Mennonite and Amish to the extent that I encountered it in my study. So this has been something, this is not my background. The people we're talking about tonight are not my people, so to speak, in the sense of identifying or coming out from them, literally, and yet there's a faith there that I trust I identify with and am part of. And so in that sense, they are our people. So I just acknowledge that. And so some of my, this is a journey that I'm on myself. I'm not the final authority on this subject. I would like to just write a title up here for the series, and you can refer back to it throughout the weekend. Sometimes it's hard for us, and those of you who are neither from an Amish, Mennonite, or German Baptist background, we just are tremendously blessed to have you in our churches and are thankful for what the Lord has done in the contribution you make in our churches. So please understand this study tonight is not specifically, thank you, about promoting or discouraging Mennoniteism or Anabaptism in that sense, but it is simply a study looking at a church that had a clear positions on separation and non-resistance that over a period of about 100 years lost or compromised on some of those convictions and positions in some of the journey of that church. I'll be sharing, trying to share some of the narrative of their story as fairly, as honestly as I can, and yet I'm sure there can be bias mixed in and just simply from my limited understanding. But that is our heart. So we're looking at a people. I'm sure we could take... And I wanted to say as well that my wife is also not from any kind of a plain background at all. She grew up in a home where her daddy played in a rock band in the 70s and the 80s. So I have benefited tremendously from from reaching out and having fresh blood in our churches, and I am thankful for that very much. So I'm not here to promote necessarily specifically Mennonitism. However, I have a tremendous respect for the Mennonite people, and also feel like there's a lot we can learn, as Brother Mark shared. So I'll just write the series title for this weekend up here, and you can refer back to it throughout the weekend and just help remember to remind us of our theme and what we're discussing and considering. Like I said, we have three sessions, and a fair amount of the first session here is taken up simply trying to help us to understand who we're talking about. And then tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon, we'd like to look a little bit more at the narrative of their story from about 1860 to 1950, 1960, about 100 years. So I apologize if the introduction part here is a little long, but for us, especially in Amish background people, it's hard to understand. There are some quite different things that distinguish us from the Mennonite people. So the series title is... Okay. And I would just also, just this top button, till the light comes on. Yeah, the light's on, okay. So I would also just, this is more of a teaching time, and if something is not clear at all, anytime through these sessions, raise your hand, please, and ask for clarity, or we can have discussion if something you want to discuss, or any of that. So just feel free to do that. My biggest concern is that I don't just come here and throw out a bunch of information and leave, and you are left to flounder around in that, all right? So my heart and desire is to try to be clear and to be beneficial in some way, just a small blessing to the congregation here. This series title is The Old Mennonite Church. The Old Mennonite Church and the Spirit of Progress. And I will spend this evening giving a little more definition to that. Okay? I appreciate the prayer. I think we'll just go ahead and go along here, start in. I've been challenged and blessed recently again in my reading through the Old Testament to notice the tremendous love and burden in the heart of God for His people. You know, it burns in the heart of God to have a people that represent His name, His glory, His power in every generation. And matter of fact, the Lord Jesus said, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so He's going to do it. I believe that. And I believe there will be a bride when He returns. So sometimes what's interesting in church history is you see movements of people who were a part of that and a part of the Lord using them to build His church. But then it seems like they drifted out of bounds or whatever you want to call it. They drifted out of some of the parameters of the gospel and the parameters of the will of God. And they lose some of the privilege of being that people. And I want to say that carefully. The word that we're going to use is apostasy. And I want to use that word carefully. I'll give it a definition later. But so the Lord Jesus Christ says, I will build my church. And the question sometimes is, will we be a part of that? He will have a church. Sometimes we hear sometimes that the last message that Christ gave to the church was go into all the world. The last command, it's called the Great Commission. There's a lot of truth to that. But there was another time, there was still another message that the Lord Jesus Christ sent to the church. And it's in red in my Bible. The words of Christ are in red. And the message is in red, and it's red, and it's in the book of Revelation. And seven times to seven churches, He said, I know thy works. And He goes on and gives in detail some of the works of each of those seven churches. And so what that tells us is, the Lord Jesus Christ is very concerned. He's very interested. He's very involved in the church. And He knows the works of the church. He said seven times, I know thy works. And He sent a message to them. I know thy works. And we know that five of those seven, He didn't say go, but the message was, He didn't say go into all the world. The message was repent to five of those seven churches. So that's sobering, isn't it? Within a generation or two of the birth of the church at Pentecost. I like to say this, and of course, we all feel that way when we're teaching, but I wish the Lord Jesus Christ would be here this weekend to teach us this subject, because He could say, I know thy works, and He could give the most accurate and fair account of the church group that we are considering, and help point out the most clearly some of the challenges and the decisions they made that influenced them. I had to think this evening of Psalm 48, again, thinking of the beauty and the glory of the church, the people of God. And here, we see it read in verse 12. It says, walk about Zion. It's referring, I believe, to the people of God or the habitation of God as it begins here. Walk about Zion, go about her, tell the towers thereof. Then it says, mark ye well her bulwarks. And that simply is saying, set your heart to her bulwarks. Notice and observe her bulwarks. Consider her palaces. Or it says, raise up her palaces, is what it's implying in the Hebrew, that ye may tell it to the generation following. So mark ye well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces, that ye may tell it to the generation following. For this God is our God forever and ever, and He will be our guide even unto death. Okay, so Brother Mark mentioned a few reasons why we should study church history. I just wanted to elaborate on that a little bit. Why are some reasons why we should study church history? I think he mentioned already that it's a introduction into the future. That's very well said, I believe. Some others are simply to learn. We can learn a lot from the lives of others. In one life for us,
is too short to learn all that we can or need to. It's also to learn and see how people got to where they did. We can see what worked at times and what didn't work, different and the various ways that different influences affected a people or influenced a people. So we can do that. We can study and we can see, we can learn how they got to where they ended up in the down the road. The other thing we can learn is to see where we are at. And I hope to some extent that we can find ourselves in the story this weekend somewhere. And I'm not here to, I'm simply here to share the narrative. I'm not here to tell you where you are in this story. But I want to encourage us. But I know that I can find myself in the story that we're considering this weekend. And you know, on a map, if you're faced with a map, it's hard to tell where you need to go unless you're first able to see where you're at. So you stop at a rest area or something along the highway, and there's a map on the wall. And every time they have an arrow there that highlights a point on the map and says, you are here. And so in order to know which way to go, we must know where we're at in relation to the broader scope of things. We can identify wrong ideas, doctrines, lifestyle choices, patterns, directions in our lives, and repent from them. Someone has said that insanity is to keep making the same mistake and expecting different results. That's insanity. Keep making the same mistakes and expect different results. So these are things we can learn. Or we could say insanity is to go down the same path and expect to end up at a different place. And also I would just say, we study church history to be challenged, deeply challenged by the devotion and faithfulness of others. And the story this weekend, I don't want it to just be negative at all, because there are stories there, and we specifically were trying to look at different men who kind of represent influences in the time that the old Mennonite church was traveling through. I've chosen to do it looking at different men who were very influential in the church. But I am deeply challenged in my own devotion by the devotion and the zeal that characterized these men. Once again, considering some of the reason for studying church history. I was challenged pondering recently also as looking through the Old Testament how frequently the Lord reminded his people to remember where they came from, and remember his works among them. And I thought specifically here in Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, it says, "And thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee and to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no." You know, we all want to remember, and it's easier for us sometimes to remember the highlights and the blessings and the beautiful things that characterize various points in our life, where the Lord did something beautiful in our hearts, or there was a blessing there. It's a blessing to reflect and remember those things in our life. But here, the Lord was telling his people, you should remember the way that I led you, the way that I humbled you, and the way that I proved you in the wilderness to show you what was in your heart. You should remember that. That's a challenge. And he's reminding his people to remember his works among them. Okay, so this is more of a snapshot into a more recent church history, if you want to use that terminology. And we'd like to look at some of the journey of the old Mennonite church from positions that clearly identified them in issues that are of nonconformity and separation to into mainstream Christianity. So they had clear positions on some of these biblical doctrines and positions, and they, over a period of 100, 150 years, how they were surrendered some of those positions and were acclimated more into mainstream American Christianity. So apostasy, the definition is an abandonment of what one has professed, a total desertion from one's faith or religion. And the first definition is probably the way that if I use that word this weekend, that is the way that I mean it, an abandonment of what one has professed. Okay, to give you another example, not too long ago, there was an older brother whose roots go back into the old Mennonite church, and he came out of that and is currently part of a more of an Amish background church. And he told me he had seen what happened in the old Mennonite church himself. He observed it personally back in the 1960s. He went to Lancaster Mennonite High School that we'll talk about tomorrow afternoon, briefly at least, make reference to it. He went there as a young man, and he saw what happened to the church in the 1960s. And now he came out of that and is part of a Amish background church some 60 years later. And he said it just grieves his heart because he sees the same trends, the same things coming in that they faced back in the 1960s. So it's interesting. There's just a lot there for us. Now, we should especially, I think, give attention to this. I wanted to say, too, that there's various church groups or movements that we could have chosen that run parallel to the old Mennonite church. The Church of the Brethren, there's several of you here that are from a German Baptist background. The Church of the Brethren, their story is parallel, very similar to the old Mennonite church. Or we could talk about the Brethren in Christ. Their story is very similar. It runs parallel, some of the same influences, and yet in various different ways that it took them. So I just want to mention that. This is one that we're looking at, but if you could, there's others we could study and see some of the same pattern or process. We should especially give attention to this. And I was curious, how many of you are from an old order background within the last two generations, either Mennonite or Amish or German Baptist? You would be traced back to the German Baptist Old Conference would be old order. So how many of you from an old order background, the last two or three generations? It's quite a number of you. So we should especially consider this, I think, and there's a lot we can find in this in the study. Some of my own journey on this interest in Mennonite history happened in 2013 when we were in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Canada, and Joshua Robertson, who was living there, involved in their city ministry. They have a school that is still going there, and it's a blessing. You might be aware of that. We were visiting that. And he took us around the city of Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is a very unique city. In that it has such a broad spectrum of various backgrounds that are together there in this city. Back then, it was total population was just under a million people. And as he took us around, he pointed out. He said that he told us that there's approximately 100,000 Aboriginals that moved down from northern Canada that were part of the city. Some of the challenges that they face in various opportunities there to minister among them. We discussed that. And then he mentioned there's approximately 60,000 to 80,000 Filipino people living there. And I think there was 30,000 to 40,000 of the Sikh religion living there. And then around 100,000 African refugee immigrants. And so he was telling this breakdown of the various people groups that are represented in the city of Winnipeg. And I was thinking about that and thinking of the tremendous opportunity. You know, sometimes the church hasn't done very well in going into all the world. And so he told us something. He said, okay, so here's the Red River. Over on the east side of the Red River, I believe it was, or on the other side of the Red River, he said there are living approximately 60,000 to 80,000 Mennonites. And my ears pricked up. And I started thinking, oh, wow, what an opportunity. Here's 60,000 to 80,000 Filipino people. Here's all these 100,000 African people. Here's all these from the Sikh religion, the Aboriginals that came down from Canada. All these people. So maybe they didn't go out the way they should have into all the world. And now here they are all together. Just across the river, 60,000 to 80,000 Mennonite people. What an opportunity to be a tremendous witness and testimony of the Lord. Well, he took us to a used Mennonite bookstore, and in there we met some of these Mennonite people. And I was shocked as an Amish boy. I was shocked that we met. They were wearing very modest clothes, shorts, and they had earrings and tattoos and green and purple hair and everything you can think of. And I was just shocked. And yet they were very proud of the fact that they were Mennonite. And I was just, it just really struck me. This is what started my whole interest in this study, because I was all the way home, 2 days home, it was a 2-day drive home. I'm sitting in the back seat and I'm thinking about this. 60 to 80,000 people integrated, completely integrated into American society, yet still very proud of the fact that they're Mennonite. And it was interesting. So as I thought about that, I thought about it, and I just kept asking this question. I knew this was just one small part. This is just one location. And I started asking, how did this happen? What happened? And I started buying books. Some of them are on the table in the back. I haven't read those all, but this kind of started my own study. The questions, how did this happen? What happened to these people? It was interesting. I shared this series when we talked about it in Harmony, North Carolina. And sometime after that, I think it was last year, Dilgish was scheduled to be in northern Manitoba for some meetings. And he got back and he called me one day and he was all excited and he said, I met him. I said, I didn't understand what he was talking about at first. And he said, yeah, I was on the airplane and this man sat right beside me. And he was just like you said. And then we got to talk, and he's divorced and remarried. And anyway, but he said he was very proud of the fact that he was a Mennonite. And so he was, anyway, so that was interesting. Okay, so here we have in your little, your papers, your pictures. These are just a somewhat follow along. Sometimes a picture's worth 1,000 words. And yet, my heart is that we don't just focus on the external things. That's not my heart at all, but this is our journey here. So here we have the pictures on the first two, on the first page, and the second page, and then the top of page three, and simply goes along with my question: how did this happen? What happened? And this is, again, I'm not here to put down people or condemn. I just wanted to look at this story and to be as fair as I can with some of the details and my limited understanding and ability. So we can't cover all the details. But how did this happen? How did they clearly move from being a peculiar people to integrated into society? Now, again, I'm concerned that we don't just throw out a lot of information. I tend to like details, so it gets me in trouble sometimes. I mean, I bought Hudson Taylor's biography in a single volume, and then I bought the 2-volume set, and then I found out there was a 7-volume set, and so I bought that and devoured it. So I like details, so sometimes it can bog people down. I don't want to do that. But we want to start here this evening. The first Mennonites that immigrated to America, there was a brief establishment in 1663 and 1664, but that did not stay. It was plundered, destroyed, disappeared. It's somewhat of a mystery exactly what happened. But it was in 1683 that there were a number of Mennonite families that came to America and settled at Germantown, Pennsylvania. And this is the first ongoing settlement in the New World. This eventually became a part of the Franconia Conference, which was the first regional Mennonite conference in America. And so I told you there's some differences in the Amish and Mennonite understanding. One of the big ones is, for us Amish background people, it's more of a district, local church oriented in mentality. We don't have as much understanding of the conference mentality and how that worked, but the Mennonite people functions then and still do today a little more within conferences. So there's just some differences in that. All right, so this was in Germantown. There's just a lot that we could talk about in the 1700s as the immigrants kept coming. It's interesting, as you look on the larger timeline for the Anabaptist Mennonite timeline that I have in the back, I just want to encourage you to specifically notice the red dots. Those are edicts of persecution. And those, there's a bunch on there, and they come into, I think, into the 1700s. But that was forcing that in drafting, their young men drafting into the military was forcing more and more of these people to immigrate to the New World. And so through the 1700s, a lot of immigration and expansion. They faced the whole issue of the American Revolutionary War. 'Tis Seeding Time by John L. Ruth is an interesting book to read in the context of that. That's not our story here tonight. We could talk about different renewal movements that they had in interaction with Pietism. But that's, like I said, that's not our we're going to go into the mid-1800s. And as we do here, you'll see at the bottom of page 3, these are approximate dates of organization. Keeping the Trust has these dates a little earlier. But this is, there's 11, I think, regional conferences mentioned here. And again, this is slightly different in our understanding from an Amish background, but these were regional conferences that made up what was called the Old Mennonite Church and kind of when they were organized. You'll see that further west. Now, however, I will tell you this, that Franconia, Lancaster, and Virginia, those three conferences in the east were different. West of the Allegheny Mountains, two-thirds in Joe Springer and I can't think of his name, the other Mennonite historian, they told me this last year that half or two-thirds of the conferences west of the Allegheny Mountains were made up of Amish Mennonites. So that was before the Old Order Amish division, the Old Order Amish were established, which came later in the 1800s. But so two-thirds of these conferences west of the Allegheny Mountains were made up of Amish Mennonites that joined with the Old Mennonite Church. Okay, so before 1898, when most of the conferences organized a general conference, the Old Mennonites did not have formal church-wide structures, but the various bishops tried to keep themselves informed of the proceedings and decisions of other district conferences. So another reason I chose in my study the Old Mennonite Church is it seemed to be a little bit of a middle course. So if we have, it would have been called Old Mennonites. As people look back, they're called Old Mennonites. And that would have been the branch back from 1683. And we're going to look at specifically a few other branches that developed over the process from 1850 to 1890. And the Old Mennonites were kind of in the, it's called the Old Mennonite Church. We'll put them kind of in the middle of the road. And out of this, on the other side, as we'll mention here briefly, you'll see there was the Old Order division, and then there was also a more progressive side, which we'll look at first. The more progressive side, on October the 7th, 1847, 16 ministers and bishops attending the regular fall season of the Franconia Mennonite Conference, they walked out of the meeting and became the East Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference. They wanted a faith that seemed less formal, and they hoped to instill deeper piety. This reform movement was led by John H. Overholtzer. On the top of page 7, you have an image, a picture of him. I do want to say to their credit, this became what was called General Conference Mennonites. And it's a little confusing because the Old Mennonite Church formed their own General Conference in 1898. But this was General Conference Mennonites. And they had some merit. This was in 1847. So the Old Mennonite Church had slipped back. It's interesting to read some of the things previous to this, but there's no question that they were in need of some reform at this time. I think to be fair to John Overholtzer and those that joined him. I'm not saying that everything was done in their divide, maybe as the way it should have been, but Old Mennonite Church was struggling. It was at a low place spiritually at this time. And I'll talk more about that later, but just a few of them. Yes.
Was John related to Abraham?
I don't know that question. Nope, that's fine. You're welcome to ask any question. Thank you. But I'm not sure if he was or not. It's a good question. I'm trying to find out. But they were having challenges with alcohol to some extent. There was a low spiritual, some darkness there. The one big thing was that the young people were not joining the church. And we have some pictures here. We'll talk more about that later. Also, tobacco. They were facing it to some extent. They were growing it and using it. And in some churches, even had spittoons in the pulpit. So there was some major issues there. Here's a letter to some friends in Germany in 1849 that Oberholzer wrote. He lamented that the American Mennonites were in a low state of ignorance. Quoting, he was glad to say also that his group had some of the most skillful speakers. Thank God, he said. In the old church, he said, four or five preachers were failures in the pulpit. Yes, the first consideration for a minister was a blameless walk. But congregations should also choose men who could speak in a clear, distinct voice and with natural fluency. And just so went his criticism here. And so I'm giving you that as just a snapshot into some of their condition. He was probably obviously a little biased as well. But I think there's a lot of truth in what he was saying. The challenge is maybe he should have remembered the importance of humility in a minister's life as he is talking about some of these things. So Oberholzer and those with him chose a slightly different model than the old Mennonite church. It was more of a progressivism expressed, and this is how it was expressed, not necessarily bad things, but it was expressed in mission, in higher education, and in other activism. Oberholzer and those with him, it seems like they spent much of their energy, especially in the beginning years, negatively reacting against what they considered the formalism, legalism, and outmoded ways of the old church. And I have some verses here in Psalms we could look at. It just basically says we need to be careful what we say in the spirit in which we, or whether we speak about other people. That's a good question. Activism would be to be more involved in society, to be more involved in ministry to people, which are, these are good things as well. I'm not saying that these are bad things, but activism would just to be more active and engaged, involved in either in society, in ministry, and not as laid back, which I would say would be a good thing. We'll see some of that same transition in the old Mennonite church tomorrow morning, actually. So over the next decade, from 1847 to 57, like-minded Mennonites elsewhere in the U.S. joined with Oberholzer and his people to form, in 1860, what became General Conference of Mennonites in America. And I'll just refer to it as General Conference. So this was happening back in between 1850 to 1900, some of these divisions took place. The General Conference went much further in accepting two American patterns, denominationalism and progressivism. They chose to be more in the world culturally, which means they lost their nonconformity sooner. Their slogan was, quote, unity in essentials, liberty in non-essentials, and love in all things. Today, they support gay marriage, and I maybe even have them ordained. So we see, I'm using that as somewhat of a reference on the progressive side. To be fair, so this division happened in 1847, and for years, the General Conference tried to reunite with the old Mennonite church. They tried to bring it back together. Well, in 2002, the old Mennonite church had drifted far enough that they were able to come back together in 2002 to form Mennonite USA. Now, since then, since that happened in the last 4 or 5 years, Lancaster Conference, which was the largest regional conference in the old Mennonite church and was more conservative, in the last 5 or 6 years, they left Mennonite USA again, over these issues of gay marriage, etc. And it's interesting to me, just as a side note, the church at Bern, the First Mennonite Church at Bern in the corner, the big church, that was a general conference church, its whole existence. Well, when they left, when the Lancaster Conference left Mennonite USA 4 or 5 years ago, the First Mennonite Church in Bern left that and joined Lancaster Conference. And J.C. Wanger's son is there. You might not know the name, but his son is there. J.C. Wanger was a very influential person in the old Mennonite church. And his son lives in Bern, married a Bern girl. And Dan Wanger, he comes out to our hymn sings once a month, regularly, and him and I like to talk. But he's all excited about it because it's just interesting. All right, so the General Conference was more progressive as a whole. By 1890, they had 44 congregations with approximately 5,200 members. That was on the progressive side. Okay, so we said that the old Mennonite church was kind of in the middle, I would say, of the General Conference on the progressive side. Now we want to look at on the conservative side where we have the what was called the Old Order Division. The first major Old Order Division took place in 1872 at the Yellow Creek Congregation close to Goshen, Indiana. Jacob Whistler was the bishop there. And there were actually three factions in that Yellow Creek congregation. And you have a picture. I have a picture here on the bottom of page 4 of Daniel Brenneman. He had a strong push for revivalism, more of a Methodist type emotionalism. Was very strong progressive. I would say even more so than General Conference. But he was at Yellow Creek. He was in the ministry. And if you're here with an Old Order Mennonite background, please. Feel free to set me straight on any of these things. These are things I've read, but I'm sure there's various perspective on how this happened. But he kind of represents the progressive element, and you had John Funk, which we'll talk more about him tomorrow. He was kind of trying to walk in the middle as a cautious progressive who had the support of the Indiana Conference. He wanted to move ahead with Sunday schools, church publications, and some other changes. He wanted to bring some reform. He had a beautiful concern for the spiritual level of the Mennonite church. And we'll talk more about him tomorrow. His life deeply challenged and blessed me. And yet, it's interesting. It was just a blessing. We'll save that for tomorrow. So he was a young minister. He was about 36 years old when this division happened. And then you have Bishop Jacob Whistler and his supporters who were saying, and we're going to put on here old orders. He was saying no to Sunday schools, no protracted series of revival meetings, no night meetings at all, no four-part harmony singing. He was against Funk's Herald of Truth church publication and was somewhat opposed to using English in the church service. Now, there were other ingredients involved, I'm sure. And I'm sure there were mistakes made on all sides. But this ended up in a division that went clear through the old Mennonite church. It started in 1872 in Indiana, in Ohio, and then in Ontario, Canada in 1889, eventually in Pennsylvania, Bishop Jonas Martin in 1893, which was the start of the Groffdale Conference, and then in Virginia in 1900. I would just say this, the Indiana Conference put a committee in place, and some of these things are interesting to me, I don't want to get on rabbit trails, but and they admonished Bishop Jacob Whistler. So the Indiana Conference for the Old Mennonite Church, they admonished Jacob Whistler, who was the presiding bishop at Yellow Creek, minister there, and they gave him time to consider to support the conference positions, and he wasn't coming along. And as near as I understand, John Funk didn't wait on the committee to discipline. But here he went ahead as a 36-year-old minister and excommunicated his 63-year-old bishop. So I'm sure there were issues on all sides. But in 1890, before the Jonas Martin division, this was approximately, we said, 5,200 people. This was 1,100. So just to give you a little idea, that was where we find it. So the Old Mennonite Church was kind of considered a middle of the road between the conservatives. I might have these on the wrong side, but anyway, between the conservatives and the progressives. Now, it was quite a bit larger. In 1890, there were 17,000 members here, approximately. 17,000, we'll just put. And if you want a reference to help you, follow some of this. I think is on page 16 in your paper there. 15, page 15. You can study that some and look at it. It gives you statistics. On the top, you have the largest number is the Old Mennonite Church. You have the Old Order Amish there. And then you have the General Conference Mennonite is down more towards the bottom. You see 11,000 in 1906, 11,660. So you can follow it through, look at it. It gives you the growth over the period of about 20 or 30 years. So you can reference that if you get confused. Also on your picture nine is a picture of the what's called a Yellow Creek Frame. And that is where the Whistlers meet today, which would have been part of Jacob Whistler's group. Below that is the Groffdale Conference meeting house at Yellow Creek, just within a half mile. And then on the page six, both pictures are the Yellow Creek Brick, it's called. And that's the Old Mennonite Church here. So you have, of course, the Whistlers and the Groffdale are both out of this division. Okay, so I also shared that the rest of my title is The Spirit of Progress. So we kind of tried to establish here who we're talking about the next two sessions, the Old Mennonite Church. Maybe we spent too much time there, but just trying to help you to understand who we're talking about this weekend. The rest of my title is The Spirit of Progress. And I got this from a rousing speech given by John S. Kaufman, who again we'll talk about him tomorrow, was given at Elkhart Institute in Elkhart, Indiana, which was the forerunner of Goshen College, was founded in 1894. In 1896, John S. Kaufman gave a resounding speech, just a stirring, stimulating speech that he titled The Spirit of Progress. And it's interesting because see, not only was the Mennonite Church facing this concept of progress, but it was in society in a major way in America. They were going along. There's interesting. I read a quote earlier today from a book that was written in about 1886. But it was promoting America as the true kingdom of God and how we must. We must evangelize the rest of the world with American Christianity. And it's just a very interesting concept, but it was all about progress. And the Mennonite Church kind of picked this up. And he was, here's a quote from his speech. Here we are at an epoch that marks a transition period in our beloved brotherhood. It is really a final crossing over of a large body of our people. The way having been gradually prepared from the German language into the language of the country. What will the result? What will be the result of this transition? We fear and tremble as we think of what might be. Let us never say there is no danger. You see, he's recognizing this. Only the true spirit of progress, given and directed and kept by the power of God, will form a pavilion around about us in which we can dwell in safety from the encroachments of popular opinion and worldly aspirations that will come dashing upon us with the fury of a sweeping cyclone. Jehovah will preserve us. But on the other hand, we are thrilled with pleasure as we paint in our mental vision the beautiful picture of a multitude of young men and women going out from this institution. He's talking about the Old Mennonite Church's first institute of higher education. This was the vision in which it was established on. But on the other hand, we are thrilled with pleasure as we paint in our mental vision the beautiful picture of a multitude of young men and women going out from this institution, the mind stored with knowledge, trained to make the best of all their faculties, possessed of a will to do right, that will acknowledge no defeat, armed with a character that will never shrink from maintaining true principles, a trust that relies solely on the favor of God for success. So it goes on. It's a very interesting speech, but he's addressing them, and he's a... It was a lot of beauty there, and a lot of genuine beauty. Here's another quote as an excerpt from there. Had the Mennonite church cultivated the spirit of learning which her people originally possessed, we might be a people famed for learning, and our congregations might number thousands where now they count only hundreds. We in Mennonite education should permit nothing to prevent us from maintaining the high standard of Christian life that has been defended by the teachings of our Mennonite people through their whole history. So just a few quotes from his address there. And that's where I get my title, because the spirit of progress, it was on the whole North American nation for sure, probably on the world, but it also came into the Mennonite church. And it's not a bad word, progress. But the world was caught up with this, and the mentality and the teaching was there that men would just get better and better until you have a utopia. And then the First World War hit, and it shattered that. Man was not getting better, and they were sinful as ever, even though they were increasing in knowledge. It is only God that preserves a people and preserves a nation in holiness. So as I pondered this era from 1850 to 1960, whatever that we're considering, I think this quote, the spirit of progress, captures what I think of as a push of the time. Is progress wrong? Is progress wrong? No. What was that? Depends on the direction. That's a good point. Without God, yeah. Those are good answers. Definitely, as a word, progress is not wrong. We're admonished over and over in the scriptures to press on to perfection. So I would say there's something wrong if we're not making progress in holiness, progress in spiritual things, maturing. So we're not opposed to progress. May we make much spiritual progress in our generation. But few things that we should be aware of. I think we should be aware of who defines progress for us, how we define it, and who defines it. That we have a biblical definition for it and not just a cultural one. So may the studies this weekend help us to see the need for carefulness. We must make sure that our progress that we're having is not based on a reaction from our past. There's a big thing that stood out to me in this study. Sometimes we're saying we have progress, we have tremendous progress, and we don't realize that we have reaction mixed in. Our progress must result in the fruits of Christ-likeness and not in the fruits of worldliness. So I want to talk about one individual this evening. I don't have a picture of him, but he was a very influential man his life has deeply challenged me in his influence and just the way he poured out his life. So I already referred earlier that the old Mennonite church, the state of the old Mennonite church around the 1850s, was a need for reform. Like I mentioned, some of their alcohol, tobacco usage. The other issue that they faced was the people spread out because of expansion and opportunity in new land. So they were consolidated more in the east, and as they saw opportunities for new land, homesteading, etc., they saw the opportunities in the west, and they pushed out and expanded. Many times what happened is they went to new areas simply because of the opportunities when there was no church there for them. There was no there was no church established there that would help them and walk with them and disciple them. And so many of a large number of the Mennonite people were lost to American Christianity simply through going out to new areas with opportunity, and there were no other churches there, so they just started attending the churches that were there. Another issue they faced was church services were 2 to 4 weeks. Sometimes they would share a church house with, it's interesting, one account was there were 4 different church groups that shared the same meeting house. Like Baptists, Methodists, and Mennonites, I forget the other one. So each one had a Sunday. Well, you go somewhere, and so you ended up attending the other services as well. And again, I'm not here to just to just put down American Christianity either. That's not my heart. These were some of the things that were happening. They got involved in politics, somewhat building up before the Civil War in 1860, and that brought them some real heartache. It was not a good move, not a good choice. But so there was a spiritually low time for the Mennonite church. There was a need for reform. I have this, the one big thing that stood out to me was the lack of the young people joining the church, especially before they were married. And here we have a few pictures here that help us to see that. You have the top of 7 and the bottom of 8. You see the young couples there. Those are wedding pictures, or I believe are around the time of their wedding, and they're not in order with the Mennonite dress regulation. So you see it was an issue. The young people were not joining. The church was losing out. One of the men who rose up to had a burden for this was John M. Brenneman. Before we mentioned his brother Daniel, that went in more of a revivalistic direction from Yellow Creek Church. And I'm sure he had some of the same burden himself and felt like that was a good option or a good choice to help his church. But John M. Brenneman, his life, he lived from 1816 to 1895. It's a slightly different, I want to say, a different spirit and character in which a spirit that characterized his ministry, maybe we should say. But he had a beautiful and a challenging testimony with a dear shepherd's heart. I don't have a picture of him. He had a burden for the Mennonites who were getting involved in the Civil War and fighting and losing their non-resistance. So he wrote the pamphlet in 1863 called Christianity in War. And I have some of them back there. If you want one, feel free to pick one up. If you want to make a donation for it, I think they cost me around $4. But you don't have to. If you don't have the money, just take one if you're interested. But he wrote that back in 1863. He had a burden for the Mennonite people joining, like I said, losing their non-resistance. He wrote another pamphlet or a little booklet called Pride and Humility. And he wrote quite a few other things. But anyway, he had a burden. This is what the Mennonite Encyclopedia says of John M. Brenneman. He was from Elida, Ohio, which would be Western Ohio. He was a bishop there. Just says he was an earnest and a zealous worker in the church. And actually, the time period from the 1860s to 1900 is referred to as the Mennonite Great Awakening or the Mennonite Quickening, and we'll talk about that tomorrow morning. Actually, that's our discussion. From 1860 to 1900. But here you have a man, John M. Brenneman, who had a heart to see the church reformed, revived, and he poured out his life for that, but was characterized with some different spirit maybe in his ministry. But like I said, this is what the Mennonite Encyclopedia says. He was an earnest, zealous worker in the church, and he was so absorbed in carrying out his task as overseer in the church that he gave little consideration to his temporal affairs. He made long, arduous trips to the West, visiting brethren who had moved into isolated communities. Remember what I said, how these churches, these families saw opportunity in the West and they moved to isolated communities. He had a burden for those people that were there without church and without shepherds. And he traveled, he spent much time traveling, pouring out his life to minister to these families. On one occasion, he took the train to Iowa, to the end of the railroad. Then he drove 80 miles south in a two-horse wagon and returned east on another railroad. So my observation was that, this is still from the encyclopedia going on. He was away from home almost constantly, preaching, holding baptisms, communion services, and seeking to bring people of both Mennonite and non-Mennonite background into the church. Although he was deeply concerned with the spiritual advancement of the church and with the scriptural doctrines and teachings taught by the Mennonite church, he was always ready to adopt new methods. He was a pioneer in the organization of Sunday school work in his own and other congregations, even at the expense of losing friends or offending certain members of his congregation. He was inclined to look on the dark side of life. I wouldn't have to mention this, but a section in one of his books is entitled, Why a Christian Should Not Laugh. During his later years, shaking palsy made him inactive in the ministry. He had little formal education. So this gives you a little picture of this man, dear man of God, who had a burden for the people of God. He had little formal education, but he attended elementary school with his own children. He was a prolific writer for the Herald of Truth, but Funk, the editor, once said that all of his material needed complete editing. Even with this handicap, he was a vigorous thinker and a powerful preacher and evangelist. And then it says this about him, due to his wide contacts, in the third quarter of the century, so from 1850 to 1875, he was as close as anyone to being the leader of North America's largest Mennonite branch, the Old Mennonite Church. Probably the most influential man as he poured out his life, ministered, had a heart, real heart to see spiritual life come into the Old Mennonite Church, to see them, to preach against some of the challenges that they were facing, and he had a real heart and a burden for that. And yet, when I see his, when I read his writings, when I see his life, he was careful in that. He was, we'll see tomorrow as we look at some of the other men who powerfully influenced the Old Mennonite Church, they were maybe not as careful in some of the things that they brought in with their reform efforts. But his life is a beautiful, challenging example of devotion and sacrifice for Christ and his kingdom. I think we'll just stop there for tonight with on that note. And then tomorrow morning, we'd like to pick up on what's called the Mennonite Quickening, looking at from 1860 to 1900, some of the reform, the quickening that happened. And you have to remember that in the middle of this happened about that time. This happened in 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. And we're focusing on the Old Mennonite Church. So, like I said, a lot of information. Hopefully your mind isn't spinning too bad. But any questions, I'm trying to answer things that aren't clear. Yes, brother.
At the beginning, you said you wanted to talk about, was it apostasy? And is it fair to say that what we're looking at is not so much the apostasy of the Mennonite Church as the how those who were looking for a revival and renewal and were seeking God and stepped out and how those movements ended up apostatizing? Is that sort of where you're going with
it? Yeah, well, the word, thank you for the clarification. The word apostasy, I would say, would come in, I would use it later. We're looking at it in the context of this.
Right, but that later. Church was already apostatized, right?
What's that?
The old Mennonite church was already apostatized.
I would feel like they left, as the definition of that word is, they left the place of previous.
Right, the things that you're talking about
right.
This evening.
So what we're looking at is, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say that The church you were talking about, the old Mennonite church, the church had already apostatized.
You're saying before 1850?
Yeah.
Well, there was definitely a sense of, the spirituality was low.
Yeah, maybe.
But there was still a heart and a desire to serve the Lord, like John M. Brenneman.
Right.
If Christian
right.
Burkholder would have been early 1800s, right. And his writings were powerful and addressed to the youth. Beautiful things there, but yeah, you're right. There was a sense of apostasy. They were needing revival.
You mentioned tobacco and spittoons,
yes,
and pulpits.
That's right. Exactly.
Abraham Overholt had Mennonite man had the largest whiskey distillery in America at that time. He was married to the deacon's daughter.
Yeah. So there was definitely that element of apostasy. That's right. It's good. Good point.
Actually, you might find it interesting, Jim Beam, which bought Overholt, is putting out bottles this year, I think it's Centennial bottles or something, with the old Overholt label on it.
Who is it?
Jim Beam Whiskey.
Really? Are you serious? It's amazing. But yeah, that's what it had. There was spiritual decay. There was a need there for revival. So you see the heart of John and Brenham and these men, we'll look at tomorrow, some of the heart that they had for that. Okay. All right, well, turn it over to whoever's closing here. Please pray for me, and just like I said, we desire to some way be a blessing.